My name is Greg Hill.
And I'm Kyone Wolf.
And we are
comedy professionals.
When you do comedy every day, it becomes like a well-oiled machine.
We can do comedy like that about any topic.
So send a comedy idea to Greg and Kyone at WNPR.org and we'll perform it immediately. What does it say?
It's from Buster in Middletown, and he says, Finding Nemo, but this time it's chicken instead of fish.
Let's just run with that.
Okay, Finding Nemo, but with chicken instead of fish. And scene. You say something first.
No, you go first, and I'll build on it.
Okay, how do you do? I'm a rooster.
Cock-a-doodle-doo! A rooster would say that.
How do you cock-a-doodle-do?
We're rolling now.
I'm a rooster, and one of my baby chicks with a congenitally damaged wing has been abducted by scuba divers.
That's so depressing.
I know, right? But it's the plot of Finding Nemo.
Like if scuba divers stole one of my kids?
Yeah, man, you would be like a total wreck.
I feel like, I just want to go home and hug my kids.
You should totally do that. Just take the afternoon and be with them.
You don't mind?
No, I don't mind. I got this, Greg. Wow, I am really worried about him. What were we talking about? Comedy. Well, what do you want to do? Laugh all the time? Like you're some kind of clown? Let's face it, some things are pretty serious. So here's a very serious conversation about comedy recorded live at Watkinson School recently. And now, if Joe Buck were the next Batman, I think it might sound something like this.
So, I mean, Julia, teaching classes about this, so you've got to think a little bit anyway, in a way that most comedy people don't like to do. You've got to think systemically or systematically about how things get to be funny.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think that improv means like you get up and you just like do whatever, and that is a recipe for disaster. Because it's similar, actually, the process that you're talking about, except the real world demand is, you know, you're making it up on the spot, often in front of an audience, and so you've got to find something, right? So there are strategies and rules and, like, techniques into how you break something down and figure out what's funny about it for you or what's funny about it for the audience. And that, I mean, I agree with your categories, and I would really add patterns. If something is happening over and over or a pattern has emerged, like there's probably comedy in a pattern. So when we teach classes, we're teaching people to like look for patterns, but more than that, to like notice what they're saying. It's amazing how many people talk or like have experiences or go through the world and just like are paying no attention to what's going on. So like a lot of improv is about noticing things and listening to things just right there in the moment, because then you get that sense of surprise and discovery of like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just came up with California raisins who wear sunglasses and dance. I'm a genius. It's incredible, because really what we're teaching people is just pay attention to themselves.
When you say patterns, can you give an example? I don't want to put you on the spot, but a pattern that you would look for? Or like...
Sure. A pattern. I mean, well, for real improv nerds, this is called game, looking for the game. So what's the unusual thing that is most funny about the situation that we're in? So let me think of a recent example. Okay, so I was just in an improv show the other night where it took place in a mall, and it was all about someone being pregnant, and basically one of the patterns that emerged was like everyone there had a last name that was related to a mall store. So the big like moment of discovery was we were talking about Hot Topic and my name was Annette Topic. And we just discovered that in the moment, and it was huge and it was really funny. But then we started saying, what are other mall things that could relate to this? So then it all kind of hung together. It doesn't sound funny when you explain it, but watching people figure that out is what's funny. That's what's fun about improv, is watching people like peel the banana right in front of you and like find it for themselves for the first time. But I think a lot of stand-ups go through the same process. They're just going through it in private instead of in front of a million people.
When I'm having to write intros and stuff like that, I'm sort of in the same position that they're in. I'm trying to think, how can we take something and reverse it, you know, or...
Yeah.
Take it in the other direction or juxtapose it with something else. And I always envy people who are writing plays, because it seems to me you're not sitting there thinking of jokes. You're thinking of characters. I feel like that's more organic and whole, and, you know, it feels purer somehow than the degrading thing that the other three of us have to do.
Well, to make it like to get to that pure place though, as far as with comedy and particularly with having to like not only be funny, but like have this be either a linear story or at least have some sort of like abstract theme. it's like, how can you be funny? How can you think of these things? You need to be able to, I think, kind of be a split brain kind of person, because you need to be able to have multiple personalities and speak with the different personalities to be able to make, particularly like, I'm not as familiar with like all the rules of the improv that you're doing, but like, it's the same thing where it's like, we need to make this work, because if it's one voice, and it's always kind of more amateur or weak writers that are writing in this one voice, not able to kind of break themselves apart and be the inhibition of just being like, no, these people are, I don't have complete control over this, but what would be funny if this character's talking back to this other character I've created, and being able to think of it that way and not just be like, I find this funny and this funny. It's just a little bit different. You have to sometimes either find yourself funny or...
Yeah, like comedy is all about, at least for me, perspective. So you want your characters to have different perspectives that are playing off each other. You know, if everyone has the same point of view on the world, like, that's not funny. But if we have people who have clashing opinions and they have very strong philosophies, that is a lot of the funny stuff that we find in improv too.
Right. I mean, it's like, it's always interesting when you meet someone. For instance, like one of my more successful shows was the favorite characters, audience after audience, was these two female characters in their late 50s. I'm not a female in my late 50s. But the fact that we're able to explore that voice and be truthful to that, and for me to kind of go, oh, what can I do with this, and makes, and again, the unexpected or the surprise of what you, where directions I'll go with that, and not restraining myself but being true to these characters, is kind of interesting on that end as far as telling a story.
You've already broken like five rules of improv. You can never say, we need to make this work. You can say we need. That's like the rule. There are a lot of rules in improv. It seems... Like, what?
You're just making this up. You're doing it. You're doing a great job. I just want to add here that, like, I thought that I had seen
You can't add things either. That's against the rules.
I thought that I had seen good improv and, like, and experienced a lot of improv until I came to your show, and watching you do the show every day, I was like, oh, my God, this is improv. Like, I don't think you guys understand what is happening in the background. It's like he's a piece of paper with random notes from 50 different people, and then they're just coming up with this show day after day. So, like, you do know. You know what the rules are. They're innate in your bones.
Oh, you know, I have even more rules than you do. So, and Brian, one of the other things, like, watching your stuff on YouTube, I mean, one of the other things that you're doing, obviously, is playing with people's sensibilities. And you're talking about things, including planes exploding, apparently.
That was my job.
Yeah.
Improv right there. That's not good.
I mean, some of it is, shock's probably the wrong word, or is that the wrong word?
I don't know. It depends on what I'm talking about. If something like super profane, then yeah, shock's probably the right reaction. Sometimes you just got to cross your own line to realize you still have it. Not saying that everything I talk about is so R-rated or anything.
No.
But.
No, but for example, I was watching you talk about asking the audience if they'd ever been approached by a stranger offering them candy.
Yeah, but that joke's more of a wordplay. See, comedy's just more, like, stand-up's more sneaky than what they do. Because if I want to have a conversation with somebody in a bit, stand-up's just a monologue, so I have to portray both people, or, like, be that other person, or how I react is what's funny, or my anger, me getting angry at, like, the person behind me in the line at CVS, or whatever I'm mad about.
Well, I want to talk about that, too. I should say one of the things he says is... was it ever the case that you would have gone with them except they had the wrong kind of candy?
Yeah. Makes you think.
Yeah, and I said, if, like, candy corn, like, get out of here. If that was a Snickers bar, however, we'll go in your van, but... That was a very G-rated of what I asked.
Yes, I'd like to say I really appreciated how you toned that down. It was actually funnier the way you did it the other way, but I still appreciate it. Thank you. So, I'm also wondering about anger. I mean, it seems like, I think for a
that
lot
might
of...
might be a Connecticut thing, though.
Anger? It's all repressed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then you have a microphone, you can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
You can get drunk for free, probably. So, you have an outlet now.
Right. I mean, for me, like, I have this thing that I've been sort of writing... that I haven't finished yet, that's sort of an attack on TED Talks. Because, like, I hate TED Talks, and they really make me mad. And everybody likes TED Talks, right? They're really revered, too. There's something about going after something that everybody likes, too.
This is such a TED Talks crowd. I'd watch it.
Yeah, no, I know.
I was going to say, what do you call this? Like, three TED Talks happening at once right now? Like,
But this is good.
Yeah.
This is good.
Really good.
We got a carpet. Right. My picture's up there.
We're a TED Talk without being prepared or expert.
Yeah, I mean, we could do like a slam poem over here, and then we could be in a better.
You guys won't learn anything, and you won't forward it to anyone. You get everything else.
Yeah, it's like, easily the worst TED Talk ever, but... But we're still proud of it. So, Scott, you're kind of cheating. You know, you're living in Willimantic. I feel like that might give you... I mean, that maybe that's funnier than living in Connecticut.
Well, it's definitely interesting. It's that funny thing about Connecticut where the, like, national perspective about the state is that we all live in these huge houses and have Stepford wives and live that life. And then you go somewhere, you're like, yeah, my next-door neighbor, he's a crackhead. Real nice guy. Real nice guy. But... it's just the very different parts of Connecticut. That's just this weird national vibe that we're the punchline of all these different things. We're the filing cabinet. We're the liberal-conservative kind of vibe that we're this weird split state. So, yeah, it's...
We did all the heroin jokes at dinner. That's the truth.
It's you know, you don't want to bash on it too much.
No, don't.
But, not in the best shape it's been. But it's fun. It's
colorful. That's what I was getting at. It is
colorful. There's you definitely have the drug addicts and you have everything else going on. But it's got such a really interesting like art scene as well, and the people you meet, because again it's cheap to live there, so you'd meet a lot of people.
Yeah. So Julia, I feel like with Connecticut's reputation, I think Scott nails it. We are often called America's filing cabinet, stuff like that. It's insurance. It's defense, and particularly Hartford is insurance, defense contractors, Puritans who are. A million laughs. And you guys have done this amazing thing. You're creating an improv, physical improv theater after, how many years has CT existed?
Seven. So for context, we will be the first dedicated improv theater in the state, which is huge. In Connecticut's storied history, there has never been a single theater just for improv. Well, you have New York, there's so many, they're tripping over each other. Boston has a million. But it's really an interesting question, is Connecticut funny? Because what actually Greg said to me when I told him about this panel about, he's like, wait, that's really two questions. One, is Connecticut funny? Two, does Connecticut have a sense of humor? And those are two different answers. Yeah. Connecticut is definitely hilarious. You guys are like, which is the answer to the second question, is that the second you start like saying anything that I think is funny, somebody's like, well, 50 years ago, there was this thing here. And I'm like, I don't care. You know what I mean? Don't tell me the history. Like, if you know me, I love history. It's not about that. It's just like having the perspective to see something with clarity in the moment is something that Connecticut is, to my mind, like very poor at. So like, give me an example. No, I'll give you the example. I'm from New Jersey, and New Jersey gets made fun of a lot, you guys. And do you guys know what New Jersey's current state motto is? I think this is the funniest thing I've ever heard. It's come see for yourself. That is amazing. Well, Connecticut, and that was probably written by some dude down at the pier. And we'll spend like $10 million to come up with like the word Connecticut again, like, because that's the least offensive thing we can think of. And I think it's really fun to be able to kind of try to give Connecticut back to yourself and to itself. And I think the heart of comedy is just like holding the mirror, saying like, hey, look, you guys are ridiculous. And we're included in that in improv. Like, it's less of a vibe of like, you're stupid. And it's more of a vibe like, we're all ridiculous together. And I think that's why we've been successful, is people are like, yeah, I did say that. Ha ha. And it's been really fun to get people to laugh at themselves. But it is hard. It's very challenging because our natural instinct is to be defensive. And to your point, about money, I think a lot of humor always comes from punching up, of like really good smart humor is like, you're the underdog and you're just like killing the richest person, and it's easy to make fun of them and it's easy to make them look bad. But like in America, like Connecticut is that we're the monopoly man. That's the perception. So it's weird to be like, no, we're not, we actually suck. That's not something people are comfortable with saying or admitting. It's like, you can't make fun of it without admitting their flaws. It's so fun. When we first started doing improv with like corporate people and like really uptight people, and one of the best shows we did in the last couple of years is These Nuns Hired Us. And they're like a convent. We did this big show at a convent, and they were like, they called us, they hired us, but they were like, oh, we're so worried about this. They would call me like once a week and be like, I don't know. I don't know. And then we were like, okay, we're still coming. And they loved it so much. And they didn't want us to say anything about anything. But then, like, the nuns themselves were like, Jesus, like, who's someone you would want to date? The Lord. And we're like, okay. So that's really fun. Because they're participating. We're just, like, feeding back their own ideas to them in a fun or funny way. So it's been really a delight to do comedy for people who are scared of it. It's my favorite.
You know, Julia, 50 years ago, we didn't have nuns.
Yep.
Or heroin. But I think there's also the mystery of, I'm moving away from the Connecticut part of it a little bit. But, and Scott, I'm sure you've had this experience. I've had it, of standing at the back of the theater on different nights and watching audiences have completely different sets of reactions to the same material, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just sort of one of the mysteries of comedy.
Well, I mean, that's also, like, it's the smaller a room of people with, the bigger the risk, too, because you don't know, like, you could be doing the same material, you could be doing the same show or the same act in different places, and, like, I mean, if it's a bit, like, the internet, a perfect example, Brian's saying, when you're that big, you're bound to find your crowd, but with theater, it's such a gamble. With improv, it's such a gamble mm-hmm. in the room, because you don't know. I mean, you can, in situations where there is the improvisation, if there is that ability to read the room, you can kind of adjust, but in a setting like theater, it's just like, you're like, well, this is the product, and they're not buying it. Let's get the hell out of it. Let's finish up, get off a stage, and go cry and drink ourselves. And you know,
I just comp a bunch of nuns because they're, you know, nuns are crazy.
Nuns are the best, but it's true. I mean, comedy is all about the audience, you know? It's like finding, connecting with them, and what you do is so difficult for that reason. It's like once you're 5 minutes in, like, that is it, whereas we can adjust second by second, minute by minute, and, you know, stand-ups can too.
On a positive note, it's getting better, I feel like, because it's been an easier sell as years have gone by for me. I mean, it used to be that to get original work done in Connecticut, like not at a large theater, it was pulling teeth. And because everyone's like, no, they want to see this show. And they're doing, you know, for the Blue Hairs. And they want to say that. But you're like, the Blue Hairs, I mean, the age demographic has changed so much. You're doing shows from 30 years ago that were old then. And now you're talking like it just boggles my mind. We did a Whacked when we did that show of mine, which is a show about masturbation in Turkey, if you need to know. And it was
the country, not the animal.
Yeah. It was takes all kinds, whatever it takes to sell another
David
copy.
Cameron got in a lot of trouble for that. So.
But like, and the thing was, but you had like, you know, I had one night we had this whole group of women that were in their early 80s walking out, and this one little old lady, I love her to death, she goes, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen. And it's like, because again, it's like what she's been watching growing up. It's like comedy was popular 40 years ago, was a lot more crass than what was 60 or 70 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I feel like people ignore that sometimes in Connecticut. They get focused on, well, 50 years ago, mm-hmm. what was...
turkeys were chased.
Yeah.
They didn't do that.
Well, you didn't talk about these things, but then you look about, like, I mean, in as much as I hate it sometimes with television has helped push that bar a lot of the times, being like, when I was a child, you know, everyone in middle school, high school watched The Simpsons, and if you weren't, the edgy households only let their kids watch The Simpsons, mm-hmm. and now you watch that stuff from television compared to what it is now, and it looks so tame, because mm-hmm. Things just, the times change, and I feel like we put anything in a theater, on a stage, on a pedestal, and it has to be a certain level of humor when we forget that, like, the, you know, 2,000 years ago, one of the most popular comedies was a satyr play with Ulysses being beaten to death with a giant penis. So, I mean, it's just like, I digress.
That's the sound of music for people who don't know. But we'll be back right after this from Watkinson. All right, so let's bring our improvers back out, but from CT Improv.
Now's your chance. What's something funny about Connecticut to you? Still revolutionary. Our new motto. Yes, we have progressed. We've progressed from Connecticut's rising star to, wait, no, we were always, you know, always revolutionary. Yeah. We were back then and we still are, right?
So wait, isn't Hartford New England's rising star?
It is.
So there's a new Connecticut motto?
Yeah.
Who was just like, you know what? We need a new motto. I'm a little tired of this. Like, who makes that call?
Well, what was the motto before? Do you remember?
Was it the land of steady habits? Was that still there? Maybe we didn't have a motto.
I don't think there was one.
Yeah, we didn't have one. That was the problem. And everyone just kept pointing at Hartford and saying, come on.
Is it actually a motto or is it just the thing on the commercial?
Yeah, I mean, the state paid $20 million for this campaign.
Yeah.
So not to depress you, but...
You know, people have fight songs that inspire, and maybe one of the thoughts was like, hey, guys, like, Connecticut has morale issues. Like, honestly, when I was in high school, my sister really wanted to go on a cruise. And so when she graduated, we went on a cruise. And they at the beginning of the cruises, they had, like, shout-outs to people and where they were from. And they were like, okay, and we got the Mortensen family from Brooklyn. And then, like, 100 people were like, yeah, Brooklyn, yeah. Oh, and we got, you know, the James is from New Jersey. Jersey, what? And they were like, okay, and, you know, here are the Ludovici's from Connecticut. And they were like, you know, 100 people who are like, clap, 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 clap.
Golf clap
shyly. Right. But I'm like, that's Connecticut, right? So, you know, it's like, oh, man, we need something.
But for a cruise boat, that's like revolutionary, to be polite and like calm.
But it's trying to get Connecticut back to its like, hey, man, we used to go to war. We're risk averse now, but we used to be out there fighting for the rights, you know?
Through a motto?
Do you guys think the revolutionaries would want things to be, like, exactly the same? That's what I think is funny about it. Mm. We're still exactly the same as we were.
Nothing changes here. Land of steady habits, yeah.
How just unnecessary is a motto? Like, that's our motto. That's a sentence that we are similar to. Like, why do you need a motto at all?
New Hampshire has live free or die. Yeah,
okay, that's,
you know?
We should just... Take that, Mike. Like, we're going to do the same thing as New Hampshire. Live free or die.
All right. So we're 5 minutes outside of New Hampshire.
Yeah.
By morning, we'll be back in Connecticut with their motto. No one will be the wiser.
That's right. Definitely not. No, I couldn't find a Charter Oak, so I hid it in one of their New Hampshire elms.
Does anybody have musket bullets? Because I couldn't find any.
Oh, I am stocked up on musket bullets.
Oh, cool, because I brought the muskets. So you got the powder?
Yeah.
Well, just another night guarding the state motto.
How are you?
What an honor, you know? I've been dreaming about this my whole life. I was born and raised Nashua, New Hampshire, right here. It's an honor to be here.
Your grandfather guarded the state motto. Your father guarded the state motto.
It's just our luck. They keep it right by the border.
Yeah. I cannot wait to get rid of our motto, swap it with theirs, and leave them with the stupid muskets. I mean, we really ought to upgrade our weaponry.
We will. Or we'll die doing it.
Right. We're already living by their motto.
I don't know what would happen in New Hampshire without its motto, you know? I mean, the state would just fall apart.
Guys, you want to load the gun first?
How are you living, by the way, Paul?
I'm living free.
That's right.
I'm living free, Theodore.
Or you know what?
Or I would die.
Yeah.
Okay, with our powers combined, we can shoot them once every 30 seconds, okay?
I'm just going to stretch. Hey, New Hampshire! Huh?
Connecticut says hello. And
Paul.
Goodbye.
Theater.
Paul!
No. Live free, man.
Yeah. I can't.
Then die. We've been thinking about inspiring the people.
You're right.
Of Hartford. And so that's why we've started with Connecticut's rising star, okay. New England's rising star. Stars, they can live for millions of years.
I like that. We're like that. Mm-hmm. I want to be like that.
Yep.
That motto.
It takes millions of years to be born, but also millions of years to die. Right. So it's like the sun of New England.
Right. When people think of a hot ball of hydrogen and helium, I want them to also think of Hartford.
Yep. Just gravity, just pulling them right into Hartford at all times. Like, people will start just powering everything from Hartford.
Well, that's really great, but I want to see some of the other mottos that you brought me here today.
Oh, yes.
I mean, that one's good.
Yep, no problem. So, yes, here we've got, of course, Hartford. We still have insurance. So I know a lot of businesses have left, but not insurance.
Right.
It is still the insurance capital. Most of the insurance companies actually moved their headquarters elsewhere, they allow us to call it the capital because they keep satellite offices here.
Right. We want to remind people of what we have.
Honey, this seems like a safe place to move. They still have insurance there. How practical.
Oh, still? They still do. But you know what? I heard that they kind of moved the headquarters out, though. Is it still going to be a safe place to live?
How about this one? Okay. It's a city, people.
People.
Yeah, no, it's a city, comma, people. Because people are like, oh, no, like, there's crime in Hartford. There's crime in every city, like, you know? Like,
just telling them what to expect.
Yes. Like, it's a city, people. There are going to be safe parts and dangerous parts and crime.
I'm just
like,
waiting for the page to load. So I know that you like living in a city, and it says here that Hartford is technically a city.
I'm not sure. It doesn't seem, I don't think city when I think of it. I just think not a weird job.
How about this one? You know? Okay. It's safe to cross the street either way.
Wow, I like that. There's a dual meaning there.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
You're interrupting the loading process. I just want to.
It's one of the few cities where, because they're risk-averse, everyone gets a red light, and you can just dance in the street. Yeah. Like, either way, you can do the double cross, you can cross this way. Like, just highlighting the safety mechanisms of Hartford.
Wow. These are all really great. I mean, I know I hired you as a consultant, but I had an idea of my own.
Oh, please.
You've come up with some great ideas here, but I just feel like, you know, we're too timid. That's what people think of us. So I'm thinking we got to say, Hartford, let's get loud.
Ooh, you know, I don't really like that.
Sports game, amp up.
I don't really like that. I like a nice noise ordinance.
I was hoping to live somewhere where the sounds outside our window at night was like a deer licking a child.
And that's that set.
All right, you guys. That's a set. I want to talk a little bit about two aspects of modern life. And the first one is this kind of notion of trigger warnings, this notion that, well, I mean, for example, Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld, people like that, say they won't play college campuses anymore. There are too many things that are off the table, too many things that are off limits. That, I mean, comedy is almost invariably transgressive, and there are more groups who feel capable of being transgressed against. I don't know, Julia, you're nodding. That means you have to go first.
I was nodding because I was like, I know what you're talking
about. You didn't have your arms crossed.
I was there for the infamous Dave Chappelle incident. You guys look like a Dave Chappelle crowd. That was a joke. Yeah. But he was doing a set at, what's it called? The Meadows, which is not what it's called. That's what they called it like 30 years ago, but that's what everyone calls it. That's Hartford. He was doing a set at the Meadows. I have not lived here in the lifetime of Meadows, G Fox, Say John, but I know everything about them. And, you know, it went really badly, and there's like this big break where he got really mad at the audience and they got really mad at him, and it was terrible. But like, comedians are asked to play in bigger and bigger and bigger places now, which I think is just horrible. I don't know how you feel about that, but like, it just really hurts the intimacy of what stand-ups have to do. And I think some of that, like, comedians having to become stars is playing into this problem of they're offending more people because more people are seeing them, and they're seeing them from, like, further away, and they don't feel that intimate connection. But I do think that some, you know, colleges and college students, like, Seinfeld in particular comes to mind, is like, he's old now. He's a little out of touch with what those students might think is funny. And if he's doing old material and they don't like it or they're not connecting with it, then it's kind of on him to, you know, work on his act a little bit and think about what he's doing. So, like, I feel like I can see both sides of the issue. is you have to like really work hard to keep up with what people are interested and into. But we are also in a serious moment where a lot of people are taking a lot of things very seriously. I think rightly. It's really hard, I think, to walk into a crowd of thousands and thousands of students and then bomb if you're Seinfeld or Chris Rock. But I also think, you know, you guys have been around a while. Like, you got to continue to work and find a connection with them in a new way.
Yeah. Watkinson wanted us to do this in their football stadium. And I said, no. I said, no, it's got to be intimate. It's got to be small. Not, yeah, what are you going to say, Scott?
I agree on the intimacy end of it. But I also feel like social media has kind of created this desire or right or authority for everyone to have this live in the moment commentary with everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has to comment on something as it's happening. And so you go to a comedy club or you go to a show and people have to talk about it or live tweet about what's happening rather than experiencing something, watching it, laughing it. Maybe you got offended at something, but having to go home and be like, well, you know what? Yeah, maybe I overreacted to that rather than be like, oh my God, I've never been so offended in my life. Like mm-hmm. flipping out about it or talking back to the comedian because I deserve the right to comment on this now. And I shouldn't just maybe respect what everyone else is experiencing right now on anything, any sort of entertainment. But I don't know. It's this weird authority that everyone feels they have now to.
Totally.
I mean, it's like free speech is great, but it's like, you know what, maybe you should let the thing that we're all trying to watch and enjoy and respond to and laugh and then take it home or maybe respond afterward. Or I keep hitting your microphone. I'm out to get her. But
so that's a microaggression.
Yeah, sorry. If anybody's offended by microphone movements, the rest of this show might bother you. But like it's and the microaggression thing I think is very sensitive too because I agree like there's certain things. It's like – but that's – leave that to the comedian to decide what they, you know, they're going to try things and they're the one who's going to suffer for it if the audience doesn't go with them. I feel like being like, no, we have to constantly cater to just the audience and everyone else being offended by something is a little absurd.
When I first started on public radio, I was amazed at the level of sensitivities that people had. And I would get emails. I made some little throwaway joke about, I don't know, yeah, he's allergic to shellfish. And I get this email from this woman saying, you know, I ordinarily find you funny, but I have allergies in my family, and I was offended by that joke. And she asked me to publicly apologize to the entire allergy community. I didn't even know there was an allergy community. I was starting to think what their meetings are like, and everybody's sneezing and like breaking out in hives and stuff like that. And similarly, and this will touch a particular tripwire here with at least one or two of our participants. I had a bunch of people in the show from Lego, and we were talking about sort of the disparity between boys and girls, and girls don't play quite as much with Legos. And I just said to the people from Legos, well, why don't you put out a Justin Bieber kit where the girl can build Justin Bieber? And I come back to my computer after the show, and there's this angry woman saying, my daughter uses Legos, and she's 8 years old, and she builds buildings and machines and things like that. She doesn't need to build Justin Bieber. And I'm writing back saying, it was a joke. And that's not a defense with some people. It's a joke.
I'm just getting mad just thinking about it. I'm still thinking about shellfish later. I should have sent her a gift card to a seafood restaurant. Put $100 on it and be like, have yourself, oh, my bad. I just think the whole thing with political correctness is, it's like I'm still thinking about the shellfish lady. Like, what did she really expect you to do? Be like, you apologize. She's like, good.
Yeah, right.
I will never eat Red Lobster again.
Yeah. Breaks her arm patting herself on the back.
But the thing that bothers me about that, too, is quite frequently when I get one of these things, people say, I ordinarily find you funny. And I'm thinking, well, that means you weren't offended by the things that offended, like, the shellfish lady and the Lego lady. You thought those were funny. Now I'm offending you.
It's all jokes until it's something they're sensitive about. Then it's statements.
Yeah.
Like, I was just joking about shellfish. Like, no, that was a serious comment you were making about...
That was years ago with Isaac Hayes flipping out about the whole Scientology thing. He was cool with the South Park guys making fun of every religion in the world, but then it got to Scientology and he flips out of that.
Right. ET Improv is Scientology, by the way. I don't know whether you know that or not.
Or a cult. I totally agree with everything you guys are saying. And I, for the record, South Park is my favorite show, so I'm not like easily offended. However, I do think we're at a moment in our culture where it's like, you know, to be frank, and this is partially my fault because I invited this particular group, but like I'm the only woman here in like a group of 9 people, and like 100 years ago, like woman beating, I want my wife to die jokes were like the rage. So, like, yeah, there's going to be moments in our culture where people are suddenly like, you know what? We're not okay with this. And I think gay and LGBTQ humor has turned that corner. And, like, I think everybody has to be more self-aware, mostly Red Lobster Lady or whatever. Like, it's mostly on them. But I don't think that just because you're a stand-up comic, you get to, like, never think about how people are receiving your work. You know what I mean? I think you have to do it. You have to go through the process. But, like, as I agree, like, people should be going home at night and thinking about what just happened. But I include the comics in that responsibility.
And I agree that, like, and
thank
you. Yeah, absolutely. But social progression is going to be its own thing. With, I mean, yes, comedy falls into that, but I don't think we feel that we should be constantly, like, hamstringing comedy or other types of arts because we think that it might impact the social progression. I feel it's going to happen, and that's why, to me, it really matters about the intent and what happened. Again, it's taking that back and thinking about it. I think a lot of comedians, Brian, we talked about this dinner, like, some comedians are just out there to be a jerk and just to offend people, and they're just out there to get that line out there. But I feel that if the intent was to be a joke, I can understand why it was well thought out. I feel it's the responsibilities on the audience as well to go, well, you know, this isn't something I normally laugh at.
I think the way that people who really object, you know, are feeling is that is the moment of social progression. Of people saying, like, you know what, Bill Cosby raping people, like, all of a sudden you don't get a pass anymore. Obviously, that's a very extreme, very current example. But, like, comedy is at the lead of our culture. You know what I mean? Like, right now it is so huge. Like, everyone is into comedy right now. So, like, maybe that is how social progress is going to change. We can't be like, you know, after the Senate votes on XYZ, then we can, then the progression is over. I don't believe in that at all. Like, if comedians are going home and being like, whoa, maybe I can't do, like, floppy hand gay humor anymore, like, that's obviously great. And maybe, you know, the people that need to, like, be having that progression in their mind are the people going to comedy clubs and not the people who are thinking about this in other more academic ways.
One of the questions that I have is, I mean, everything feels very sped up these days, obviously. And I'm wondering what that means. I mean, for me, like, I'm writing comedy sketches 4 times a week for the radio, but I'm also finding if I have 2 seconds, I'll tweet out a joke. And I guess the good part of that is it keeps the mechanism pretty well oiled. But I also sort of wonder, first of all, are you finding that? Are you finding that just sort of the pace of digital life changes you as a comedian?
Yeah, you can get fired from just something you tweet now. Like, that's absurd. How do I get fired from the job that I run by myself? Like, that,
right.
You know, that's insanity. That's why I don't post anything on Twitter. I save it all for Facebook, all my evil. I guess that's a safe ground still. I don't know. I just think it only has power if you give it power. Like, if you let the people that get outraged, but, like, if you just did something and, like, 3 people were outraged in a room full of people laughing, if you ignore it for 5 days, it's going to go away till the next person that outrages somebody goes viral or whatever. Mm-hmm. You got to be patient. No one's patient anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like what Scott was saying. You could instantly write your opinion now instead of, like, driving home and calming down, then, like, oh, I just got the joke or something. Like, get a cup of coffee and, like, cool off for a little bit. Like, oh, this has no meaning on my life whatsoever. Mm. Well, I'm going to go watch The Blacklist now.
And it's the good and bad of that, too. Like, I mean, I love it and I hate it because the part where I completely agree is you get these people that aren't making a joke and are posting stuff out there in this immediate world, and they do get fired, and you're like, well, yeah, that guy was either a racist scumbag or was beating the crap out of somebody in a sports stadium because somebody took or spilled his beer, like, because everything's immediate. Everyone's got a camera now. But then you can be really funny, and I love, like, Vines. I think Vines are a great way to be like all these little funny things that are out there. But
do you guys know what Vine is? It's 6-second videos. That's it.
That loop in infinity.
Yeah, it loops forever. I can tell.
So should we just do a Vine?
Yeah, we can do a Vine.
Like, here's, like, a Vine, like, wow.
That backflip,
whoa!
Though.
8 million views right there. That's comedy now. I just don't
good night. Thank you.
Yeah, comedy's that. Or, like, we put this pressure, I feel like, now that we have to leave a comedy show now, like, a better person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, the way that guy talked about farts, I feel so introspective now. It's like, no, just laugh. Right. Have a good time. Like, get 2 beers, have a steak, and go home.
But
don't hate your life for, like, an hour. Yeah. That's all it is.
We'll be back right after this from Watkinson.
Cheesy, I tell you, dying is easy. It's comedy that's hard.
Today's show was recorded in front of a live audience recently and produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kyone Wolf, with huge assistance from our friends at Event Resources. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Shecky Green. Our interns are Stephanie Reef and Ross Levin. For show pages, articles, and audio of the Here and Now staff telling knock-knock jokes, go to our website, WNPR.org/Colin. Tomorrow, a party-switching show. And now, back to Colin.
So put up your hands if you have a question about comedy, about anything we've been talking about.
Do you ever think you guys have had your brains wired differently than the average person?
I'm thinking that right now, actually.
We get this question so much in CT, like, I could never do that, or how is this happening? Everyone is innately funny, or everyone innately at least finds things funny.
Well, let me just stop you there. How many people up there, up in the audience, think I'm not funny? I mean, that you're not, that I'm not funny, but nobody thinks that. So how many people have ever had the thought, well, I'm just not funny? Is anybody in the audience think that they're not?
There's
well,
a few.
No, not you.
It's not true.
Everybody is funny.
That's so funny of you to raise your hand right now.
Yeah, that was hilarious when you did that.
But sincerely, so I worked in insurance for many years, and you know, I'm an introvert. I was a computer engineer, and I just assumed, like, you know, I did not want to talk to other people because I assumed they didn't want to hear what I was saying. But I started studying improv to feel a little more comfortable in my own skin, to feel a little braver, to learn. And improv is really, at the end of the day, it's teaching two people how to interact together and agree with each other and find, you know, basically just treat the other person's idea like it was brilliant, and that makes everyone feel good. So I find humor in my own insecurities, and but it's fun to put that out there and to play that with other people. So everybody in this room is an interesting person. You have unique stories, and you're funny people, and you know, by studying it in many different ways, whether you like improv, whether you want to write, whether you want to do stand-up, it can be studied, you know, and learned as an art. It's an art form.
I do think that there are two kinds of people in this world, though, and I think this all the time, and I think it's a bigger divide than any other. There are people who think they're living in a drama, and there are people who think they're living in a comedy. And I think it's a bigger difference than political differences, religious differences. I can get along with almost anybody who thinks that he's or she's living in a comedy, and I find people who basically have a deep, dramatic, serious reaction to life a lot harder to communicate with. I do think that those. Scott, yeah. What are you going to say?
I think that there's humor in everyone, and there's humor about everyone's life. I don't think everyone's capable of seeing it all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think separates like a true comedian, like whatever your style of form or medium of comedy is, you're able to see it all. I think some people are either unable to, or they have other like things that they're repressing that they're not able to see all the humor about themselves or about the world. And that's the difference to me. It's not that they're not funny. It's just they can't see any of the humor. And I think that's that mm-hmm. same type of people that like they see their life as this drama, or the world as this drama, when it's really this sick comedy.
Mm-hmm. Who else? Other questions?
One question I have, just because I was intrigued by all of your answers about like why Connecticut is or isn't funny. Like, I grew up here, and I lay awake at night sometimes thinking about how I can escape. And I'm curious, like, what keeps you doing comedy in Connecticut if hypothetically there are funnier places elsewhere?
A court order. Yeah.
I like doing comedy here because the comedy community in other places is, like, too much. It's, like, comedians hanging out with other comedians is, like, fun to a point. And then at the rest of the point, you're like, oh, this is a lot. This is, like, too much. It's great and very interesting to connect with regular people about what's funny to them. Like, I've said a lot of very warm things about audiences, but I do try to push them, like, hey, nuns, remember, you're married to Jesus or whatever. Like, that is more fun to me than going and, like, slogging it out in a terrible place, you know, in Boston with all the Boston college bros or whatever. I mean, really, one of the best things for CT is that, like, to be honest, like, it's such an undersaturated market. The amount of stage time that we get is crazy. In other cities where there's so many comedians, like, it, and you do want to hone your act in front of a real audience, you know, it's really, really hard to get, like, 2 minutes, like, once a month in front of an audience. That's terrible. We do hours and hours and hours of comedy every month in front of audiences, and that has made a lot of our improvisers get better much faster. That's a huge benefit to Connecticut. But to you who wants to escape, like, go for it if you want. But remember, the original answer, like, Connecticut is funny. It's the people in it who are not seeing it, to Scott's point. Like, there's so many cool and funny things about Connecticut.
Yeah.
But you have to see it, and it's on you. Like, that's what I like about Connecticut, is that Connecticut's on you. Like, if you have a problem with it, like, that's your issue. That's not Connecticut's issue.
Julia, you found the new motto.
I was going to say.
It's on you.
And there's so many platforms, like what you're saying, as far as, like, getting out there for your medium in Connecticut. As much as we joke about being a little dry sometimes, there's these great, like, niches for different types of artists. The reason why I do honestly stay here is some of the best playwrights I know are in Connecticut, and actually have historically come out of Connecticut. And it's just, there's great history to that. And just really interesting festivals. And for me anyways, as a writer, like, I think there's, like, lots of great minds to speak with.
You know, most people in Connecticut like to go to New York and Boston, so they, like, appreciate the art already, which is, I think, what's different than if you're in, like, the boondocks of Nebraska or something. So you guys all like comedy and theater, but you also don't like going out that much. So you're not going to go far away every weekend. So you're like, I like that comedy that I saw in New York 5 years ago. Where can I see that? And then you find us.
Well, and I think that's also, you know, Speaking of slogans, I said this so many times that a guy made up a little baseball hat for me that says, Hartford, the city that actually needs you. But it's kind of true. And it's kind of funny, too, that if any of you move to San Francisco, San Francisco will not care. You know, you'll show up in San Francisco, hey, I'm here, and then we don't care. You know, we got plenty of people who do what you do and whatever. I mean, here, people really are absolutely thrilled when you show up to do anything.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, this does sound like I'm lowering the bar a little bit, but I don't mean it that way. I mean that every talent that you have, you're not good. I mean, there are a lot of cities where you can be funny and talented and wonderful or good at whatever you're all good at out there, and no one will care. Here, people really will be excited to use you. I mean, if you really want to show up and be part of something culturally, I mean, people will make use of that. And I think that's actually a really good thing. So, I mean, I guess that's sort of the same thing Everybody's saying.
I just think this whole situation is very Connecticut right now. It's got a big group of people gather around, talk about whether it's funny or not. Like,
yeah.
You think they're doing that in Wisconsin right now, like with all that cheese lying around and not talking about Wisconsin?
But to exactly that point, the reason I'm here, and I think a lot of us are here, is because Connecticut deserves and needs to laugh. It needs to get that sense of humor back, right? And it has it, and, you know, you're good people, and you are laughing, and you have senses of humor, but we got to admit that about ourselves and say, like, that's a healthy thing. You know, we don't all want to die of heart attacks at 50, right? Got to laugh. It's healthy.
I think it's hilarious, your point, though, about that bringing it back. I never even thought about it, but it's such a Connecticut thing, the distance, and why sometimes maybe our audiences aren't as energetic, because they're like, oh, I gotta drive a half an hour to see that show. But like my friends like in San Antonio, they're like, oh, I gotta go get groceries, it's like an hour drive. Like an hour you're in like Massachusetts, so
yeah.
And I had to wait in line for 7 minutes at that thing in Hartford.
Oh God. Earlier we were talking about like waitresses at different areas, like the very Connecticut don't have a sense of humor about urgency. They're like, no, I need my food and I want my food now, where like a waitress talks to you in down south and we're like
oh, yeah. Hey, how you doing? Whoa, yeah. Easy now.
Right. I had a docent in a museum in Alabama say, who are your people? I thought, well, that's like a very existential question. And why do you want to know that? I mean, you're just showing me this museum. All right, we're going to have to stop there. First of all, I want to thank our Chippendale dancers, our grunge flannel Chippendale dancers, Greg Ludovici, Nate Gagnon, Steve Yankee, Brian Quagan, Daniel Davidson. And now a big hand for our panel up here, Brian Bargagnier, Julia Pistel, Scott Stephen Kegler. Thank you for coming.
Hey, Greg, what's another word for Connecticut?
That's not funny.
Yeah, that's about right.